Good evening, everyone. Today is February 2nd, which is the birthday of James Joyce and also the anniversary of the publication of his book Ulysses. It was published 101 years ago. And he, I believe, was 40 on that day, so he would have been 141 today. And as you know, I'm often inspired by Joyce and his work, his life, and one of the things that is so extraordinary about his work, particularly Ulysses, is that it's really a manifestation of moment-to-moment life, life, just ordinary life as it is in this moment, which is unusual in Western literature, maybe in Oriental, you know, haiku, we have more of that spirit. Other Asian art. I recently heard a man who is a musician who plays the Indian flute. His name is Steve Gorn. He's actually quite known in music world, but he played with some jazz musicians. He was influenced a lot by John Coltrane. But his instrument is this Indian flute. I can't remember the name. Banrushi or something like that. But it's a long kind of bamboo type flute. And he told the story of how he came to that and when he first discovered it. He was kind of the hippie era and traveled overland to India. He's American, so I'm assuming he didn't travel overland across the Atlantic Ocean. But once he was in Europe, he traveled overland to India, which in those days you could do, and a lot of people did. Now it wouldn't be possible really because there's war zones and hostile territories and it just isn't the same. In any case, he did this. He showed up in India, a young hippie, and someone had told him about this music. And because I think he played the clarinet in the United States when he was a young man, he played the clarinet. And he eventually came to this great teacher, kind of happened upon it and ended up staying there. But he said the way that the teacher taught was he didn't really teach you anything. You just sat there and you were just there with him, whether he was playing or not. And, you know, it was a roundabout story he told, but eventually he tried to just copy what the teacher was doing. And of course, that wasn't what the teacher wanted. And that wasn't making that was not within the spirit of this flute, of this music. And eventually, there was kind of some different adventures, but he had felt rejected by the teacher and then eventually asked the teacher if he could stay. And the teacher said yes, because he had understood what the process was and to how to learn. And We usually think of when we learn something, the teacher gives instructions, we follow them, and we master the technique, whatever it is, photography, music, Zen, dance, cooking, physics, whatever it is. And yet this, I mentioned this about the flute player because I had said Joyce's work is very much in the moment and Oriental art is usually very much in the moment. Whereas a lot of Western activity is not about being in the moment. It's about learning a technique, a concept, and repeating it. In the late 20th century, art was very conceptual. It became very conceptual. And a lot of, some people in the Buddhist world who were artists turned away from that because they were turning away from concepts and returning to the heart and the moment and the ordinary. And this flute player was one of them. And he told how he, the music he makes is very much related to where he is at any given moment. And he gave a little example, a little lesson online, and he showed what he was looking outside his window and then played. And so people watching, you were seeing what he was seeing out his window and listening to what the music he was making. And it actually did change the way that you hear the music. It sounds surprising, but it did change. I personally would not have heard the music in the same way if I hadn't seen what he was looking at. And how does this relate then to, we come back to James Joyce and why that has meaning for me, and why I think it's a great teaching for all of us, his work, and that I've tried to introduce it in this practice to more or less some effect. The reason I say that is because Joyce, he engages with everything that is around him. And the characters engage with all of life. So it's not like they only engage in lofty activities or beautiful paintings or scenery. They engage with it all, moment to moment. And in that, for us as readers, and I think probably for Joyce as a writer, there's like a dissolving of what we know and how it should unfold. And this is why many people have trouble with the book. I know so many people who have stopped reading it on page 75 or thereabouts. Debbie raised her finger. My brother recently, someone gave it to him for Christmas and he was very excited about it. He'd never read it. And I was very excited that he was going to read it. And, a couple weeks later or months later, then the subject came up. This was last Christmas, not this most recently. The subject came up and he said, oh no, I stopped. Page 75. And he said, I really don't care what happens to these characters and what they're thinking about. And if then in that case, it's a good idea to stop it, because if you don't care, then there's no point really, And I'm not saying that he should have cared. I totally understand why he stopped it in that case. The rewards are great if we continue, though, if we can engage with it, if we can read it from the heart, maybe, something like that, with an intention to let the world in, to let Joyce's world in, to let the world of the characters in, something like that. And it takes, it does take some determination, I think, maybe. Of course, there is an element of, we do need to connect in some way with it, you know? And because it's kind of obscure, Dublin in 1904, a lot of his references are so much of the time and place that we can't relate to them. So it does help. I had, when I first read it, I had a book that had notes that would say whatever he was, explain what he was referring to or something. Or people I know who have read it, they read it like in a university course with the help of a professor, which makes a big difference too. But there are many books like that. And there might be other works of art that are like that. You know, we can't, we don't get, I don't know, some surrealist art or something. Or, you know, Jeff Koons. Personally, I don't get Jeff Koons. I don't know if everyone knows who Jeff Koons is, but, you know, like, inflated rabbits and big, you know, giant metallic hearts and things like that. It just doesn't really speak to me. It doesn't mean it's not worth it, but it's true. If it doesn't resonate, then we don't, we put it aside, right? Maybe if someone, it's, you know, some art I came to have an appreciation for either through like art history courses or my dear Dharma brother, Frank, who really has introduced me to a lot of art that I might not have paid attention to otherwise. At the same time, and the same thing is with life, art and life, because for me, it's the same thing. Can we come to it not knowing? So put us, dissolve our desire to know, dissolve our need to know, and trust what we see, trust what we experience when we see, trust our heart, you know, like I said, see with our heart. And often what happens is we become attached to concepts about what we're seeing. What we're reading, what we're experiencing, what we're feeling. And then we lose touch with what our heart is telling us. This is what koan practice is about. As all of you who work on koans know, it's really a process of helping us to dissolve our knowing, to maybe something like educate our mind with the wisdom of the heart or something like that. Return to the wisdom of the heart, maybe something. And although in the ironic thing about Joyce's art, his work, is that it seems so lofty and intellectual and pedantic and like you have to be a great scholar to understand it. And a lot of, you know, he even did say, Joyce, after he published it, he said, my work will keep university scholars busy for decades. And it's true, it has. But actually, you don't need to be a scholar to just be with what is, as we all know in our Zen practice. Yet we want that security of knowing. We want to be able to understand. Uh, Myself, I'm not really well educated in music. I played an instrument when I was 5 years, between the ages of 10 and 15. I know how to read music. I know when I like music, but I really don't know anything. Like classical music, I don't know anything. And even jazz, I can't really tell you much about it. I can't tell you what key is being played in. I don't know. And yet I'm able to appreciate the heart of music. But I have to let go of wanting to know, of wanting to know what the experts say, or wanting to know what what you're supposed to like, or what people, my friends, what they like, or be able to talk about it in a very informed way. I realized recently that I read, as many of you know, I'm a news junkie, so I read lots of newspapers every day. And for example, I read the pages about books and culture a lot. In fact, in French newspapers, I always start at the back and go to the front. So in the back, you have all the, what we call back of the book in journalism lingo, which is the stuff that is it's considered less important than the front of the book. So in the back of the book, you get sports, you get culture, you get commentary, usually. You might get cooking, something like that, but you wouldn't get business and news, international news. So I read from the back. And I read a lot of book reviews and movie reviews. And I realized recently that I don't necessarily, I know what the critics say, but I don't let that affect my experience. So I'll read, you know, a critic doesn't like a film or something. But I go to see the film and I have my own experience of it. I've learned through my practice not to be influenced by those critics. But this is, you know, I'm talking like 30 years of practice of letting go, of trying not to engage in a fixed way with my opinions or other people's opinions or what I think I should like and not like. Someone said recently, eyes don't have opinions, which is really interesting, because if you just see and then your mind judges what you're seeing or categorizes it or creates a story around it, but the eyes themselves, they only see, they don't have an opinion. So I try to stay with my eyes just seeing, and then have the connection between my eyes and my heart instead of my eyes and my mind, my thinking, discursive mind. Of course, this does take some courage. It takes some bravery to just be with, to let go of feeling secure about things, because having an opinion and having an idea about something is safe. But just plunging into it with no idea or no opinion, it's kind of frightening. So it takes some courage. It does. And yet, as the ever stimulating Alan Watts said or wrote, there is a contradiction in wanting to be perfectly secure in a universe whose very nature is momentariness and fluidity. Another way of saying there's a contradiction in our desire to be secure in this impermanent, insecure, and not insecure, but this impermanent, ever-moving, fluid universe. So that it does take bravery, does take courage to do it. But our practice is about that. You know, we just sit down on the cushion and jump right in. We just jump into the fluid, momentary nature of this moment, which is changing all the time. Which will not, which brings us no result. Again, you know, I say often, you know, we're so caught up in wanting a result that we miss just what is here. And actually the wanting the result is keeping us from seeing what's just here. So we kind of are cutting, you know, pulling the rug out from under ourselves by wanting the rug to be there. Seems kind of crazy, huh? So when we're sitting on our cushion, we actually have this, we have the opportunity to just experience what is here right now. And we do have moments when we do experience that. And then we find ourselves caught thinking about something else, wanting something else, liking or not liking, judging. Oh, this is taking too long. I'm going to stop. I wish the person would hurry and ring the bell. I'm hungry. No, whatever it is. And then, as we say, when that aha moment, when we realize we're doing that, is really a perfect moment, because then we're suddenly aware, we're suddenly right here. But then, like within a flash, we go back to, oh, wow, I'm really getting lost today. Or, this is really boring. This is, I'm tired of this or something. Or you could really then focus on, oh, that aha moment. I'm going to make this last. Well, as soon as you try to make it last, then you're caught again. But we have the possibility to then let go again, dissolve once again this need to hold something, this need to be somewhere fixed, this need to engage with what is basically a distraction, or whatever the story is we're telling. Or whatever the thing is that our attention has been given to. But it is possible at every moment to just experience whatever is right here, right now. And often we get caught by that, in that this concept. And so then we say, we start calling it something, the present moment, or things as they are, or here and now, which that's what we're talking about. But we get caught on the words. And then we are already far away again. that same woman who I heard say that eyes have no opinions was talking about the photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson, who was this amazing, beautiful photographs, and who actually was a Buddhist practitioner. I don't know for how long, for his whole life, but definitely in his last decades he was. And he said that this woman said, I don't know exactly what the context was, but someone asked him how he took such beautiful, well-composed photos that had all that we would think of being, you know, the composition in a perfect photo, which can be very, you know, specific and elaborate, and yet were very spontaneous. And he had this, you know, famous thing about the instant, his photos, I forget what the term was, the moment, the right moment or something like that. Does anyone know Cartier-Bresson's phrase? No. She had read in one of his books or interviews that when he was asked that, how he was able to do it, he said, because there's a moment when the heart and the mind and the eyes are on one axis. And that's the perfect moment. It's another way of saying when we are one. When we are one with what is, and then boom, that's the right moment. Whatever we experience in that moment is perfect. Of course, everything we experience in every moment is perfect, but we don't experience it that way. So what he was saying was that when the heart, the mind, and the eyes were in one axis, he snapped the camera, that's what resulted. And he snapped the camera because he was feeling the heart and mind and eyes in one axis. It's conceptual, it sounds very conceptual. However, it was a real experience for him. And this woman who was telling the story also said that that was her experience. And I can understand that, and I wouldn't use those words. But I understand what they're talking about, having had my experience is that as well. You know, this is just a way of happy birthday, Mr. Joyce. You know, continual gratitude for his work and for what it has brought me and what it has brought my teaching, and therefore what it has brought you, because it has influenced my teaching as well, and my daily life. You know, it's almost like with our practice, of developing this ability to, you know, widening our openness to the world. The other day I was talking about Rupert Spira and his pots that became wider and wider. So the heart becomes wider and wider. Our experience, we have fewer and fewer blinders on our awareness and our perception, and it sometimes we can use the example of a crystal. So we become like a crystal, clear, and when the light shines through it, there are colors. So the wisdom, you know, of seeing things as they are, is the crystal. But then standing up and going into life, the crystal, that when it shines through the crystal, there's all the colors. And life is more alive. We are more alive in our life, let's say, something like that. We are more free. It feels like our heart is bigger. It's not actually bigger, it's just more open. And that's what our path is about. Our way is about that, is about being here now with what is, and then engaging with love, something like that. So, and actually, in Joyce's book, one of the characters, Stephen, is wandering around the city, and the other character, Bloom, is wandering around too, trying to find him. And Stephen is a bit of an intellectual, and he keeps asking, what is the word known to all men, all humans? What is the word known to all humans? And he keeps asking this question and pondering it and whatever. And at one point, Bloom arrives somewhere, and Stephen has been beat up by some people and is kind of drunk and laying in gutter, and Bloom comes and helps him. And Bloom is the Bodhisattva who helps the person in need. And it becomes clear then through the rest of the story that the word known to all men that Stephen is looking for and that Bloom embodies is love. So Joyce's book is about love. And we said that our practice is about love. So I will, on that, see if you want to share anything or ask any questions. What comes up for you about anything, whether something we've talked about already, what I've said already, or something else. Yes, Mark.
Good evening. Hello. I don't know if you remember me, Emmy. I remember you from Holland. I used to go with Dennis Gempo Merzel, and I remember you were coming as a young attendant of Catherine Genoa Pages. I just recall that my first session was the first session that she gave interviews as a young teacher. Was even before she started study with her. And then I remember then Genpo Sensei stopped coming to Poland, but he started to go to the Holland. There was a place near Haarlem called the Tiltenberg, and I remember I met you for the first time there, and then on the Ameland a few times. I think the last time was 2010, if I remember correctly.
I think it
was just the night before we parted. I remember the longer conversation with a glass of wine just before we parted, and I think you put down a Giacometti name in my notebook to check, of which I didn't know, but I did check. It didn't took me the whole 10 years to do that, but somehow perhaps to some extent motivates me to look around was that the announcement of Genpo Roshi that he stopped coming to Europe and that we are sort of left alone. I don't know if you remember this or not, but he announced this a few months ago. So until that time, I thought, well, I'm his student. I have my teacher, better or worse, but he's my teacher. So I wasn't looking around. But I always remember that you have this wonderful group. And I also remember that you go to Portugal every now and then. So I thought it would be nice to spread another wing eastward from Paris toward the east. So I thought maybe somebody from this part of the world can join you. Well, anyway, what I wanted to say is that it's a great, first of all, great opportunity to connect with people again, to connect with you, with old friends. Well, of course, I remember you, Emmy, but I'm very also happy to meet the beautiful faces and nice faces. And spend this evening with you, and hope will not be the last, but the first of opportunities that we have.
Thank you. I remember talking with you in Amelon, but I didn't remember writing Giacometti in my notebook, in your notebook.
You wrote me Giacometti name and also your email, and I wrote you last year, but I'm not sure if this email is still valid because they didn't have any reply. I think it was at the Hotmail domain. Anyway, I'm happy I read again today to the info at Wildflowers and
wonderful. So where are you?
I'm in Warsaw, in Poland.
You're in Warsaw, okay. Yeah.
Still all these years, yeah. Together with this beautiful Manjushri Bodhisattva.
Wonderful, thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Emmy Roshi. Most of the time I'm wordless after your. I'm speechless and wordless after your Dharma talks and. But then I feel that it's not fair not to give something when you give so much. So so I decided to say just it was like you were talking to me. Sorry, it was because you really. Reach points that I've been dealing with, especially this last week. So I thank you very much for your Dharma talks and for the points you touch and you share. Because it was like Emmy Roshi is talking to me. She is talking about what I was trying to do all this last week. And sometimes I I was able to reach what I was aiming to do, and sometimes not. But anyway, I just want to say that thank you so much, because you were really very helpful. Thank you, Emi Roshi.
Thank you, Anna. Yeah, I think we all can relate to that. When we hear a Dharma talk, we feel like it's maybe not every time, but sometimes we do feel really like it's, you know, talking to me. And Marlene?
Hi, everyone. Yes, I don't know how to say it, but while you were talking to us, there was a moment where you were talking about this haha moment. And we really are this group of, I don't know, 9, 10 people. And at this aha moment, the cat of that was behind Seo, I don't know if you noticed, the light projected the shadow on this door, white door. It's a fridge, Seo, this white thing there. Yeah, the shadow of the cat was so vivid, so perfect. And then you go on and talk about Henri Cartier-Bresson, and I was like, wow, everything is happening here at this moment. Yeah, there are moments where something is there to be seen, and we can see it. Yeah. Thank you for the Dharma talk, and so thank you for the cat and the light and the shadow. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
There is something every moment.
Yeah.
Every single moment.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. I can share how that this potential tension between just being in the moment and kind of when you were talking about concepts and the intellectual work. I'm very, as everybody knows here, I'm very into studying. That's my thing. And at the same time, I'm really trying. I guess sometimes it's not that easy, but not to lose the focus of why is that interesting to study? And does that lead to really become more free and liberated? And same thing also with music. We keep talking in our guitar Dharma circle about theory a lot, and becomes can be extremely technical. But I think it's, as Freddy keeps reminding us, it's about pleasure. It's about feeling it. And it's true. And I can see really the dynamic of the theory and understanding, and how that can lead either to become stuck with the theory and the knowledge, or how it can actually lead us to become more present to the moment and enjoying notes and enjoying the music. It's like, I mean, when we're playing. Knowing which road we are actually following, and that can be that sometimes there can be a tension. And it's very funny. I'm like the book I'm translating right now is super, super technical, this Buddhist text. And in the foreword, he says, it seems like super, super intellectual. And in the beginning, in the foreword, he says, it's not for the scholars. It's really for the people who have like an existential question. And sometimes it's hard to kind of see that in the midst of all this, of these all these technical debates and discussions about technical terms, it is about an existential question. So yeah, I'm navigating through this.
Ready. The other day I was playing with the singer I'm playing with, but I didn't feel good. I told her, I'm always reading, I'm fed up of reading the sharp of what we are playing. So I put the shot away and I said, I'd rather make mistakes and play and try to learn what we do, because we've been practicing so much and I don't want to read all the time. And when I put the shot away, I made mistakes, but then I was happy because I was really playing, even if I was making mistakes. But even if I was making mistakes, even if I wasn't perfect, because I think we are afraid not to be perfect, so we always go back to some crutches. So I was happy. I was making mistakes, but I was really learning the tune. I was really understanding the tune from inside out, because I was letting go of what my eyes was reading. I was more into what I was doing. But sometimes we are afraid to let go and we rely on crutches.
So then could we assume that if you just stick to the sheet music, you know, you just keep reading it, and you might play it perfectly, right? According to the what's written, right? And yet
you're not intimate.
Right.
You're only intimate when you away the shop.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. Thank you, Freddie. I recently staying with the music theme. I started recently. I hadn't had time to share because we had to postpone our circle this week. I finally decided to stick with an instrument and really do it, inspired by my guitar dharma circle brothers. Freddie was mentioning this experience about sticking with the sheet of music and not being really intimate with the song. And I've had the same kind of experience with a technical detail that you're supposed to do in this instrument, with your index finger, which is just back and forth movement, and although in the beginning you really pay very strong attention to it, you do it really slowly. But then actually at some point you really become the movement of the well, you might think it's automatic or something, because at some point you really, yes, you that's I think Freddie's description was perfect. You really become intimate with it. You become it, actually. So that was he was talking about reading or not reading a sheet of music. I'm talking about a specific movement with the finger of your hand, but it really resonated with me, the same kind of intimacy. Yes, which basically is a technical aspect, but then it's something else. It becomes something else, the experience. Yes, so.
And this is true for the whole of life, for every moment. Same, exactly what you're saying, of how many degrees of separation do we have between our self and whatever it is we're engaging in or with. How much do we let ourselves be touched by what we're experiencing? How much do we open to whatever is arising? And that's what, when we talk about the art of light of living, that's it. You know, that's as the koan says. You know. The student asks the teacher what's below the robe. And the teacher says intimacy. Or, what is most intimate? Not knowing is most intimate. Because knowing makes a separation. It's like a screen between me and me, but also me and you, me and the cat, me and the car passing in the street, whatever it is, you know. It's all about, being intimate. And that's what we train in doing on our cushion, becoming more and more intimate with just this, which is right now, whatever's arising. And it's not always fun, right? It's not always easy. Freddie was talking about mistakes. Dogen famously said, life is one continuous mistake. Or Mark brought up Giacometti. Giacometti, every morning he would wake up and look what he did the day before and destroy it, start over again, whether it was a painting or a sculpture, because what he was looking at now, that the next day, today, was not what he was looking at the day before. And so he started over again. He was so intimate with it that he could see that it was different from what it was the day before. At some point, he had to stop doing that. Otherwise, we wouldn't benefit from his beautiful work that we can find in museums around the world. A lot of it, though, was that his brother intervened and took the sculpture and said, this is good, this is enough. And then, or the picture, you know. And he used the same models all the time. His brother, his wife, a couple of his friends, always the same. And yet, every morning it was different. and he started over again. And this was to great despair, however. He despaired about this, that he had to start over. And yet, he was so much intimate with the momentary fluidity of this, that he couldn't accept it. Fortunately, his brother could, and so we have some of his work. So great. It's nice to hear from everyone. Old faces, new faces, Marek, who shows up out of nowhere. It's great. And I don't recall, I didn't get an email from you, but I have trouble with that Hotmail account. So write, you can write to the Wildflower account and then you're sure I'll get it.
I will. You know, it was, I think about a year ago, I received an unexpected message from the Sangha of Denis Genpa Mertzel, and there were some controversies connected with his person. And since you are not so much involved in these controversies, so I thought maybe you would be the good person to share the thoughts with, because I didn't know really the details. So, and it was the email about it, but it was already a year ago, and to some extent I got the answers by just joining the online community there, and it was okay. It was not a problem. I was a little bit unsure whether I should attend it or not, how controversial it would be, but it was okay. So, and it was the daily mail about it, and perhaps you just didn't get it, as you said. So,
I'm sorry. Yeah, no. I'm glad that it worked out, though. Yeah. Okay, everyone. Thank you. We'll see you next week or another time online.